So I'm actually here today because I'm on my way up to Santa Cruz to deliver a talk on this thing. So this, I apologize in advance because the pitch of this
My way there too.
is a little bit different than it would have been for Massive Stars kind of context. So I'm going to do my best to adjust the pitch on the fly, but when I start, fussing about ages, it's because that's what I'm really thinking about most of the time. So Stan gave a beautiful introduction to kind of the basic theory behind this thing. And I'm going to spend a little bit of time talking about what we actually see in terms of low-mass stars that makes us think that we have pieces of this right and pieces of it wrong. So this is the so-called Skumanich law. This was observed in 1972. He published this paper where he looked at three young open clusters, all of them under a few hundred million years old, and found that the average rotational velocity in those clusters declined as a function of time, and that decline went as 1 over the square root of the age. And if you back this around, that 1 over the square root of age also implies an omega cubed angular momentum loss scaling. So this is the basis. The low-mass star people, when we talk about magnetic braking, spend a lot of time thinking about how this links to age. So what we're interested in is the fact that as stars spin down as a function of time, that imprints an age dependence on their rotation rates. You measure rotation rates, you can get ages for stars, sometimes ages that appear to be better than any other method so far.
Was this measuring between stars of the same mass in these three different clusters at different ages?
I
Or the most
believe,
massive stars still on the sequence?
I believe, so your mass range, I suspect, is, I do not remember, I've read this paper, but I do not remember specifically the mass ranges that were selected. It would need to be things, so if you get above about 1.345 solar masses, depending on metallicity, your convection zone disappears. And without a convection zone, you're not generating magnetic fields, so there is no spin-down relationship at all. So those stars would have been tossed out. And then we're talking about in the 1970s, so realistically, we're not looking at things that are very low mass. So we're probably talking around solar
One
here.
solar mass.
One solar mass. Most of them, even today, tend to be around one solar mass is where you end up seeing these things. There is indeed a mass dependence, which actually shows up in this next diagram here that matters. So this is an example of one of these young open clusters. This one's half a gigayear. It's M37. And this is the actual cluster sequence. So rotation period as a function of mass. And there are a couple of features. This cluster is getting a little bit up there in age now in terms of what happens in the evolution of their rotation. When you start looking at these clusters, if you look at the youngest one, the ONC, Orion Nebula cluster at 1 million years old, this is a scatter plot. There's no relationship between mass and rotation period in this diagram. As these clusters age, you find that you end up with a converged sequence and some amount of scatter that disappears as a function of time. And you can understand the initial scatter in these clusters because they have somewhat random initial angular momentum. And under a braking law of this form, as time goes on, things spin down and converge onto a sequence. So this particular diagram is actually an animation, and I'll show you how this cluster, with this kind of a theoretical braking law, very similar to what Stan showed us, what this cluster would do as a function of time. So what you're seeing is that this omega cube dependence means that if you're born fast, you spin down fast. If you're born slow, you spin down slow. And asymptotically, that means you end up on a very tight converged sequence. This scatter in the rotation periods declines as a function of time. Old things have a very tight mass-age period relationship. And there is some slope to this thing. You see that the spin down varies as a function of mass. So that's also something that needs to be incorporated. I mean, this is a theoretical model.
This is assuming rotation magnetic field relationship.
Yes. So this does assume that there is a relationship between these two things. There's also a scaling. There is a it does scale, but it's I'll talk about exactly how we scale it, and it's one of these. So from my point of view as a low-mass star person, this is excellent news, right? It doesn't give you much information about what happens angular momentum-wise in young stars, but what it does allow is that all that messy stuff that happens early on, you get to forget. you have this very tight sequence and almost one-to-one mapping, very little scatter, that says that if I know the mass of this star, or the color, say, and I know its rotation period, I can tell you how old it is to high fidelity. And when you compare this to other methodologies of measuring ages, it actually does remarkably well, at least in this very pretty theoretical picture where the thing that's driving your age uncertainties is this scatter that remains in this tight sequence. So this is the mass-age rotation relationship. And in comparison, you have astroseismology of cool dwarfs, and these are methodologies that rely on things like measuring a luminosity and effect of temperature and placing a thing on an isochrome. So when we're thinking about this kind of spin down in low mass main sequence stars, there's a couple of different regimes that we have to keep in mind. So this diagram is usually intended for people who intend to apply these relationships. So it's color-coded like a stoplight, telling you where things are okay and where you should be concerned. The green region is where gyrochronology is something that is probably useful. This is where you have spin down that actually makes a difference, this assumption of time. Here, in this yellow band, is where your initial conditions still dominate your rotation period. You haven't had enough time to lose angular momentum to forget where you started. The subgiant branch, you're now physically expanding as well as losing angular momentum due to this spin down, and so you've got this additional physical factor that comes in and makes interpretation more complicated. And then the hot stars, you simply don't have a surface convection zone. In the cool stars, it's that surface convection zone that drives a magnetic field. Without that field, you don't spin down. So that's the kind of landscape that we think about.
This is now, or this is before you realize that actually things change?
I nuked the slide that shows how things change, but I'll be adding another yellow band.
Okay.
So this is the kind of picture that we expect things to have. The question is whether those expectations are borne out when we have systems where we can study it. So this is now, I'm going to show you a sequence of young open clusters. And we're looking for those things. We're looking for the strong spin down as a function of time, things that are much that are older, should have much slower rotation periods, a mass dependence, and we're also looking for this tight convergence of stars. All these things are features of this breaking law. And if we got the breaking law wrong, these features could break down. So we've got color now on the x-axis, which here is just a proxy for mass. And I've now switched the direction that spin down happens on this diagram. So this is the cluster I showed you before, now upside down because of this, M37 at half a gigayear. This is the slightly older Crazy B. NGC6811 at 1 gigayear, 6819 at 2.5, and M67 at 4. And so you do see that you get this very definite evolution with time. There is a mass dependence to it. You see that things here aren't changing very much. Things over here are changing more. As you go to the older and older clusters, you lose this spread of points, and you end up on a tight converged sequence. And the beautiful example of this is that 2.5-gigayear-old cluster here. This is now Kepler data that's allowed us to do this. And you see that you have this exceptionally tight sequence here, especially around solar. There's essentially no scatter in these guys. And you can use this to claim that if you believe that this scatter is representative of stars at 2.5 gigayears, an age measured using these periods would give you a 10% age. And the thing in this diagram is all these lines in the background are these theoretical breaking laws, predictions of breaking laws that have been overplotted on this diagram, not fit to it.
But they all get the sun, right? Which is why.
So the sun, this is a 2.5 gigayear-old cluster, so these lines are for 2.5 gigayears. By the time you're out to 4, they'd have shifted up. So with time,
they cross at that one, right? Isn't related to a particular constraint.
Say again?
They all cross around the same place.
That's going to be related to the fact that you've used the sun as a calibrator. Yeah, that's what's going on there. You could see things start to go funnier down here, which we have very few calibrators out there. But one of the things to note is that when you take a breaking law of kind of the form that Stan showed us, and then you make some assumptions about how that magnetic field and mass loss scale with stellar parameters, you are able to predict something. And when you plot it, this data came out in 2015, when you overplotted this thing, it matched beautifully, and it has this very tight sequence. So there's no weirdness out to 2.5 giga-years, is the point I'm trying to make here.
What's the Barnes 2010 saturation or something going on there?
This here?
The red flat.
Yeah, this is the loss of your convective envelope.
Right.
So,
okay.
So
how come the other models don't have that?
They may have assumed a different, so the Barnes did this by just choosing a color at which the saturation isn't fitting. These other guys, let's see, Mamajek and Hillebrand would have done something similar. The 2007 one, it's just a functional form, and I don't know if he instituted the same kind of.
So basically, when people decide with which remaining outer envelope you still have or don't have,
a lot of data there. So fitting that, I mean, it seems to me like that's actually important.
For example, Bill, right? Bill, when you decide that your magnetic braking doesn't work in your models, and this is what we're producing this lines, right? I mean, it's just arbitrary.
Well, and part of the problem is that as soon as the braking disappears, that initial scatter is lingering now in these guys. So you actually have quite a range of rotation periods that show up. And so you have lots of data, but that data is rather puffy.
To me, that doesn't look more puffy than up there right past the break, up at 0.72 or whatever.
So when you look at these cluster diagrams for these things, there's been some serious vetting that goes on in the stars that get put in, and I'm not sure if the full range of scatter would have been selected out here. I know subsequent looks at this data mm-hmm. has removed some of these rotation periods and shifted them in different places, particularly on the hot side. Mm-hmm. So it's not quite, just to give you a picture of before I talk about what the result is, to try to give you an idea of what you can and cannot trust about the things that I say. So we're measuring stellar rotation periods from spot modulation of stars in Kepler. This is the sun rotating, and what we're doing in Kepler is picking up the fact that a dark spot makes the star slightly dimmer, and as that spot rotates into and out of view, you get modulation in the light curve on the time scale of the period. Now, if you look at this carefully, you notice you've got spots that are moving and changing and growing and disappearing as a function of time. So there's spot lifetime in there, which is not known for anything really other than the sun. You have spots only at particular latitudes. We know the sun is a differential rotator, so you are only tracing the latitude of the spots that show up on that star, and you don't know what that latitude is. Is there something else I should mention about?
Side question. So it's the, we have this 11-year sunspot cycle. Is that true of other stars?
Yes, it's been observed in a few
same
of them.
Same period?
No. With most of the ones that have been observed with Kepler are shorter periods, just because you only had 4 years. There's some that are a little bit longer. Then you have the Mount Wilson survey stars, which have been traced over decades in calcium H and K, and those have measured cycles of, I'll show you a diagram of some of those.
So depending on where you are in that cycle, you're measuring this.
Right. You might get flatlined because you simply don't have any spots. So that's another challenge of when you look at a star, you don't necessarily know where in its cycle it is.
And I assume with the other stars, do you have any idea of the differential rotation in the stars?
A handful of them, you do. The kind of depressing thing is that when you take a bunch of you take Kepler light curves that are flat, you inject a series of signals of differentially rotating stars with sun-like butterfly diagrams and everything, and try to recover those differential rotation rates, you get a scatter plot between what you input and what you got. So in a kind of like batch sense, when you do this analysis, you really can't trust the differential rotation rates.
Coming from the fact that the more rapidly rotating stars will be more magnetic and have more spots?
Yes, there's definitely a bias there.
Before Kepler, something was known about AP stars from spectroscopy. What is known now?
You
could measure periods,
differences. Right, and have these periods been tested in against other ways to measure rotation, and under those cases,
they are consistent with V-sine eyes, but you're struggling with most solar-like stars because those V-sine eyes are a few kilometers a second at best. They are consistent with astroseismic determinations of the rotation period. The astroseismology in these cool stars is tracing mostly the very outer envelope, so they're fairly comparable, although depending on what volume you are probing and whether you have radial differential rotation with depth, you could argue that you might tend to pick up faster rotation in the seismic side versus the surface. They're really very localized at the surface, so it's a fairly good comparison, and every case we have there looks pretty good. The cluster sequences, being as tight as they are, is comforting, although you have some certain set of bias because you know it's a cluster and it should lie on a sequence. So, but this is what a light curve would look like. And this was all to say that this thing's not a perfect sinusoid. There's variations in amplitude. You've got spot evolution as a function of time. And even with, you know, this is 1,400 days of data for a star with a 14-day rotation period. And if you do a wavelet analysis of this thing, if you were to take just a chunk of even a few hundred days, here the color represents power, so red is regions where there's more power, periods at which there is more power. If you were to take like this chunk, for example, you might mistakenly measure an alias of a period instead of the true period. And so this, again, when you account for the fact that there's spot lifetime issues, there's spot evolution, you end up needing Kepler-like durations for these light curves to do a decent job of measuring periods. But we've got a lot of them now. So we have a fair fraction of the entire sample of dwarfs and Kepler have measured rotation periods. And we have a full distribution of stars then that we can look at. This is that full sample. And the sense of spin down in this thing would be to take stars that live here and slide them up, is the kind of direction that things would go. So I'm going to come back to this diagram in a little bit, but this is just to tell you that this is we have a lot of these things now to work with. So even when we don't necessarily have detail, we sometimes have a large sample of objects that we can extract some information from. Okay, so when we play this game with dwarf stars, we generally do it in a very empirical or semi-empirical way. So the vast majority of spin-down laws in the literature actually do not incorporate much physics at all. They simply assume that there's a power law relationship between rotation period, the age, where this n index is 1/2 in the case of Skumanich spin-down, and a color, which is a proxy for mass. And what you do is you go out and you grab a bunch of stars that have ages that you know because they live in open clusters, because they're seismic targets, because they're binaries, because they're the sun, and then you just calibrate this and go.
Assuming n is constant.
Assuming n is constant, yeah. The assumption prior to 2015, 2016 was always that this n is constant.
Constant.
Just constant, and generally ends up coming out as roughly equal to 1/2. My approach, and the approach that I think is something we should be adopting more often today, is this kind of semi-empirical approach, which says we do know something about how we expect this breaking to scale with stellar properties. We have ideas about how mass loss might scale with stellar properties, how magnetic field might scale. We have this you know, formalism that we can apply. We have stellar models that predict all these things, and we know that radius and convective overturn time scale, all these things evolve in lockstep. And so we can set the form of the magnetic breaking law, but we have difficulty setting the absolute strength of it because we're talking about mass loss and magnetic fields. So what we generally do here is we make assumptions about the scaling, and then we have a fudge factor out front that allows us to set it so that it matches things like the sun at the solar age, for example. So it's semi-empirical because we cannot predict from first principles the exact strength, but we have a basic idea of what the form is. In the case of
for the sun, it was actually calculated and measured. I mean there are some magnetic hydraulic models which consider it the magnetic breaking for the sun, and they from first principle they receive the same rate currently as now.
For the sun, I would definitely buy it. I don't know if that's the case for stars of different masses. And in practice, all of these papers, with the exception of maybe one or two of them, do this. This is the way it is in practice been done. Whether that's, you know, the right thing to do is not. It's just that traditionally this has been the way that we've approached this problem. Not that that's necessarily the best way. Now, as Stan showed you before, you've got in this equation for spin down a term that depends on magnetic field and mass loss. And both of those things in cool low mass main sequence stars are uncertain. So you have to figure out some way to say, this is how I expect my field to scale with mass or my mass loss. So in the case of the magnetic braking law that I have been using, we scale the mass loss rate using X-ray luminosities of cool low-mass main sequence stars, and assume that the X-ray luminosity is related to the luminosity of the star. And the magnetic field has a photospheric pressure scaling that's been incorporated. You can take issue with any of these things. They are a little bit hand-wavy because we really do not have a very detailed sense of how these things vary as a function of mass. Okay, but regardless of essentially how you do this, you get a braking law that does a really nice job of reproducing what we see in the clusters. So this is this black curve in the background is the semi-empirical model of mine, but this looks the same even with the full empirical models. And these are the open clusters overplotted here with their full range of masses shown. Now the issue with this diagram is there's essentially nothing out here that has a measured age and rotation period. And this is because as stars get older, they spin slower, their activity levels go down, it gets harder and harder and harder to measure their rotation periods in whatever way you choose to do it. And those stars that live very long, old stars in the galaxy tend to be low mass, and they just don't move on the HR diagram. So it's hard to measure their ages as well, traditionally. So we just have paucity of stars here. It had been the case that we really hadn't had many calibrators there. Enter astroseismology, which gives us a way to measure ages for old, cool main sequence stars very precisely. Whether it's accurate is a question that remains, you know, the scale is at least consistent. Whether that scale has slop to slide in any direction is a different question. But the fractional age errors here are better than 10% in many cases. And the stars that are living out here are actually not the oldest stars in the sample. They're actually F stars, which are more difficult to they have it's a more complicated process. They have less clean power spectra to extract ages from. So your very old low-mass stars are actually living in this very precise range. So this gives you a way, a small sample of stars that have precise ages and measured rotation periods thanks to Kepler, in order to try to calibrate and understand whether the braking is behaving as we expected. So the first person to look at this was Ruth Angus in 2015. She took 300 stars that had measured seismic ages that were good to probably roughly 20% on average, 20 to 30%, and tried to fit one of these basic empirical laws, and found that, in fact, it's not a constant n. She found that there are two in the posterior distribution. You have two values of n that are preferred. Some fraction of things really like the Skumanich type 1/2, but there's some fraction of stars in that sample that would really prefer that braking law to be shallower. What we did is then took a sample of a subset of those stars that have very detailed seismic ages. These are the things that have 10% or better ages, and decided to look at those in particular because there you have stars that, although it's a smaller sample, you've studied it in much more depth. So on this diagram, they live here. Now, you've got a range of masses from about 0.8 solar masses to about 1.1, 1.2. So you really should be comparing it to tracks that live here in this diagram. But you see that, by and large, things fall at shorter rotation periods than you would have expected them to, given their ages. And there's interesting patterns when you look at this in terms of effective temperature. So if you take the hottest subset of this roughly three dozen stars, you find that it follows the expected trend out to about 2.5 gigayears, and then you start to see substantial departure. For solar temperature stars, that departure doesn't happen until roughly solar age, and for the coolest stars in the sample, it doesn't happen until 6 or 7 gigayears. And that temperature dependence to where this weird behavior sets in gives you a hint as to what you might do to modify a braking law to reproduce it, at least one way of getting it. So whenever we talk about rotation, activity, magnetism in low-mass main sequence stars, we invoke the Rossby number constantly. And this is because both the rotation period of the star and the convective overturn timescale, which is the form of the Rossby number here, are thought to matter for the generation of the magnetic field. And when these two things are close to one, that magnetic field generation is strong and efficient. You care about the fact that your envelope is overturning and the fact that you basically want the fact that you want your overturning envelope to feel the fact that the star is rotating in order for this dynamo to work. Now, we can ask how this Rossby number varies as a function of the kinds of stellar parameters we're interested in. If we took a star that is solar mass, solar composition, and asked how its Rossby number varies with age, it increases as a function of time. And this is because the convective overturn timescale is roughly constant on the main sequence, but the rotation period increases because the star spins down. So Rossby number goes up. If instead we say, how long does it take me to reach a Rossby number of 2 as a function of mass, you see that it takes a more massive star less time to get there than a less massive star. So a 1.2 solar mass thing takes 2 gigayears, a 0.8 solar mass thing takes closer to 8 gigayears to reach a fixed Rossby number. And there, what you're seeing is the fact that you have this overturn timescale changing strongly as a function of mass. This injects a mass dependence into this.
Stupid question. How well do we know that convective turnover time?
Not very well. So you can there's like 4 or 5 different ways of calculating this number. They generally don't give you wildly different numbers when you calculate them, but we use the convective velocity from mixing length theory, one pressure scale height above the base of the convective envelope, and that's it, right?
You
could
not integrating through. You mean not integrating through?
Not.
When you say one pressure scale
height
above the base, you don't integrate through the convective envelope.
No.
Okay, because that's what we do.
Yeah.
We do much for the sun? I mean, for sun, the turnover time is relatively well known, but it will be not much in the valor at one pressure scale above.
Well, there's other ways.
I don't think it is well known. I mean, there's a lot of debate about what the convective, what the velocities are,
the shallow
and the convection
eddies,
zone.
Maybe, but
yeah.
The deep ones then.
So I mean, we know what we have some idea of the velocities near the surface, but not near the base of the convection zone. And the idea that there's one convective turnover time is even sketchy to begin with.
Right. Yeah, I mean, you could do an average, right?
You could do an average. I mean, really, this is just some kind of measure of how rotation is timescale compared to some convective timescale to give you some measure of magnetic field generation.
And the thing that, in terms of, I mean, we've got 2 dozen stars here, so we can't get real fine, right? But the thing that matters most for this is whether this Rossby number scales, however you calculate tau, scales the same way with mass. So as long as, and there are some differences, if you start calculating it different ways, you do get some departures. But this is mostly a way of tracking convection zone extent in these stars. And you would hope that any way you choose to calculate this number would scale in roughly the same way with mass.
Is there not a Rossby number depth thing that you could define that has some that actually just uses the depth of the convection? I mean, like a non-dimensional number that just uses the depth of the convection.
Yeah, you could probably.
Yeah, there's lots of different ways.
Yeah, I've seen there are some papers that have literally tables of different Rossby numbers calculated.
Well, yeah.
And when you start doing simulations. As well, then you don't even
mm-hmm.
really have access to these numbers. You have different hydrodynamic numbers that you can. So.
But beyond Jen's work, and there's a great volume of work that shows that magnetic activity of low mass stars does scale very strongly with Rossby mm-hmm. numbers.
Yeah.
So even though you can define it different ways, but you do see very obvious empirical scalings.
And the thing that's important, the obvious empirical scalings come up because this guy is a strong function of mass. That's what it.
Yeah,
that's
right.
Helps.
But I'm just saying it would be not. It might be a nicer way to
find
some.
Anything that's a strong function of mass.
Something that we
also
could just say. It's the depth of the convection zone. We believe in that, at least somewhat.
Or you might be
able to. Be a better way.
Yeah.
You might be able to do surface granulation timescale scalings instead, maybe. Yeah. There's other ways to go about this, but this is a well-defined way of choosing this. So. We can imagine, what we're going to suppose is that there is some critical Rossby number above which magnetic braking turns off, and this is probably could be for reasons like the magnetic field generation shuts down in these stars. That would be the kind of thing that we're talking about. So if you have a Rossby number, and you can ask what that would look like on this diagram, how does that kind of shut down change this curve? For a critical Rossby number of 1, it would look like this. So you have the star follow this curve out to the point where it hits that Rossby number. Remember, Rossby number is increasing with time. And then braking ceases, and so that star just coasts for the rest of its main sequence lifetime until it reaches the end of the main sequence, and now you have physical expansion that's driving the rotation period up. For a Rossby number, a critical Rossby number of 2, it's this, and for 3, it's this.
So could you, I mean, maybe you're about to do this, but could you just plot the estimated Rossby numbers of those stars that look like they might have shut off?
I don't have a plot that shows that, but yeah, you can give me 1 second. And then, this is just for solar temperature. So if you take this to the hotter stars, right, this whole thing shifts down because you hit a given Rossby number earlier in the hot stars. And for cooler stars, this whole thing would shift up. And you can ask what Rossby number does the best job over all the temperatures that we see, and it's the Rossby number of the sun, irrespective of whether you include the sun in this analysis. What this means, then, is that in terms of plotting things as a function of Rossby number, you'd see basically an edge, or a fuzzy edge, in Rossby number. So you'd see that things march to higher and higher Rossby number, but then they undergo a saturation, or truncation, at around a Rossby number of 2. But because they do continue to physically evolve towards the end of the main sequence, it's not a super sharp edge. You do see things at longer Rossby number. So there's definite morphology in a Rossby number diagram that you would see from this. It's usually easier to think about it in period age space for people who don't think in Rossby number.
Why are the transitions so sharp, right? Because if you have it beginning to shut off instead of just suddenly shut off.
Yeah, so this is the assumption here is that you hit that Rossby number and it's gone. And that's a simple assumption. Again, we only have a limited number of stars. If you look at the stars that are actually anchoring the size or the duration of this transition, it's very few objects. It's maybe 4 or 5. So in practice, what's realistically probably happening is there's some softening to this sharp edge. But in this early stage of things, just having an on-off switch is, I think, it probably as far as we can justify with the data that we have.
So the Rossby number itself is just a number, but what it says is that at this particular ratio of the period to Chernobyl time, you don't generate a magnetic field in your convective path.
Or you don't generate magnetic field, or you change something about the magnetic field, or you change something about your mass loss. There's a couple of other sneaky things I can imagine that might, you know, maybe at a Rossby number of 2, your differential rotation, the sense of your differential rotation flips. And if you now are detecting things at the same latitude, you now detect fast things rather than slow things. There's all kinds of things you can imagine doing, but I think I'll show you a plot in a second. So just...
Was the magnetic field measured?
Was the magnetic field measured?
Yes.
For these guys?
Because when magnetic braking in the past was kind of calibrated by measuring magnetic field through some other beacons, for example, through X-ray luminosity, because it's related to X-ray luminosity. So is there any measurement whether your X-ray luminosity goes down as your period increases in the same way, like it shuts off?
In the stars that I'm aware that this has been done for, this is Aline Vidotto's work. There are maybe 2 or 3 stars that are above a Rossby number of 2 that are actually detected. You're struggling against the fact that things just get super quiet by the time you're at these high Rossby numbers. So there simply aren't that many detections. In terms of being able to trace out what happens in the old solar temperature main sequence stars, the astroseismology rotation sample is still the most populated of those samples in terms of just physically detecting the things you need to detect to make the measurement.
But it's a little bit like the non-division arc, right? I mean, it's hard to detect those fields, suggesting that they're not as strong.
Right, and so I'll show you some more.
You can prove that that's on selection effect.
Yeah.
Selection effect, that it's a true, that the fact that the effects sort of disappear, that sort of place is potentially significant.
Yeah. In terms of the X-rays, I think people are thinking about this. I'm not aware of anybody that's done this, but I'll show you in a few slides things in terms of rotation period, measured period, and spottedness that go along these lines. Okay, so this is what the gray region is, where you'd expect things to live if they follow this critical breaking law. So the hot stars, solar temperature stars, and the cool stars. So the question then that we've already kind of seen is, what is the mechanism? And one of the potential explanations, and we do not have a solid, you know, final explanation for what's going on here, but one of the ones that I think is tantalizing is this idea that you undergo a shift in the magnetic morphology of your star at a given Rossby number. This is work from Cecilia Garofa, where she did full MHD simulations of angular momentum loss from stars. And what she finds is that as she changes the multiple order of the field, the efficiency of that breaking drops substantially, sharply. You're talking about an order of magnitude difference between a dipole and a quadrupole field.
So here, two will be a dipole?
Yeah. No. One.
Dipole will be N1?
I think it's one.
There's no monopole, right? Okay, so.
Maybe this is the dipole.
No, I think one is probably dipole. Usually one is dipole.
Yeah, there's points there.
This is the dipole, and then this is the quadrupole.
Yeah.
So the standard radial field we just assumed for the magnetic breaking is not here, right?
So that, yeah, this is not. What she does is she traces both, you know, the difference you get here is both because your breaking cares about the larger scale field. And what you're doing is, if you take away the large scale field and make it smaller, your lever arm is shorter, and so you just don't have the same kind of leverage to lose angular momentum. But in her simulation, she also traps more material, essentially in dead zones in these guys. And that contributes to the fall off of the efficiency of this breaking as you march up in multiple order. This idea has some credence in the very active, rapidly rotating low mass stars. You find that they actually, those stars, because they are so active and they are rapidly rotating, you get a chance to physically measure their magnetic fields and their magnetic field morphologies, and you see that they undergo a transition from complex high order to simple dipole at around a Rossby number of kind of 0.1-ish. They go from complicated to simple, and then what we're saying is we go from simple to complicated as you go up in Rossby number again. So there's some range where your dynamo is effective, and outside of that, it becomes less effective.
But this fall off, I mean, it happens with field strength as well.
Yeah.
So you can't distinguish, I don't think, the difference here,
right,
between,
yeah,
field strength and.
Absolutely.
Okay.
Yeah. So it absolutely could be, instead of, it could be the same morphology and your,
yeah,
field just weakens, that,
right,
could also do,
right,
it. If your mass loss suddenly changes strongly, could also help. So there's multiple things that you could do, and this is why we're not certain yet which one of them it is. But regardless of what the mechanism actually ends up being, we can say with level of confidence that there's something happening at the Rossby number the sun is at now in terms of magnetic breaking in these stars.
How is that Rossby number defined, the sun now?
Same as everybody else. So it's in the same.
I don't know what that is. So tell me what is that number? Is it
turnover time is about 50?
Turnover time at the base of the convection zone, at the top of the convection.
Turnover time defined one pressure scale height above the base of the convection zone in a solar, in a model grid that has been calibrated to reproduce the solar mass, the solar luminosity, and the solar age.
Tau, right?
And it has a basically.
Tau is usually considered to be 50 days from the sun.
Yeah, but this is not that tau. I think is far up in the, I mean, far up in terms of. It's much higher in the envelope. This tau comes from a model that's calibrated to match the sun surface properties, luminosity, radius, at the solar age and solar composition.
No, it's just that if you calculate the turnover time, fill the envelope, it will be about 50 days. And then it will be half. It will be number half, not two. And so it depends on your definition.
It depends on your definition.
The point is that it's the trend.
It's the trend that matters. It's the absolute number is not actually that important.
It's normalized, it's not so important.
Yeah, you could renormalize it.
But then you can switch to numbers, right?
As long as you use the same formula for all the different stars, it's a trend.
Yeah, but if I will go to literature, I will find to another time for some of the 50, then I will think about what does it mean, and then I'll calculate the numbers.
Read how they
define
their Rossby numbers. The fact that what you're showing is a trend.
Yeah.
I think it is suggestive that it's at a border one.
Right.
The
It wouldn't be surprising that it's at of order one, right? Okay, so, but to say it's two is, you know, another story, right? And that's why I'm, that's why I care about how it's defined, because one make, you know.
Right now, I think you should think not in terms of whether it's one or two, but whether it's very close to solar or very far from solar.
Yeah, sure, that I can.
That's what I would confidently say to you, whether it's like Rossby number equals to two, I would not be so confident in saying. Okay, so if we go now to here, right, this is a full population of stars. They are presumably undergoing whatever happens in terms of the magnetic breaking altogether. This is now a sample that's not as well studied as the seismic sample. We don't know their ages. We generally don't know their compositions. We know very little bit about any individual star on this diagram, but we have a lot of them. If you overplot the gyrochronology expectations for what the ages of these stars in the sample would be, and these two different curves represent two different gyrochronology calibrations for 1, 2, and 4 gigayears. If you naively interpret this diagram, it says that there are very few stars in the Kepler field older than 4 gigayears old. And now Kepler is pointed up and out of the galactic disk. It should have a substantial population of old stars in it. So we are not seeing the old stars where the old gyrochronology relationships would have expected you to see them. They should be populating this diagram up here. So one of the ways that we address this then is to say, let's take a model of the galaxy that gives us the distribution of masses and ages and compositions we expect to see in the Kepler field because we don't know them from measurements. Let's fold it through what we know about how Kepler picked its targets. It really liked FGK stars. And then let's use this information to predict what the rotation period distribution should be based on those things. This is the actual distribution, and this is the model distribution. Now, there's some definite differences that I'll get into, but there's certain similarities between these things that stick out. You've got this spray of young or rapidly rotating things that are, they're either young or they can be synchronized binaries. You have this band of objects that represent intermediate to old age main sequence stars, and this edge here falls in roughly the same place. So this is the oldest stars in the galaxy at 8 to 9 gigayears. In the cool sample. Now what we can do is if we shift this into linear space and ask, where is this edge? And we define it by a 95th percentile period. It looks like that. We ask, where is this edge in the model that we just produced? And it's here. And all the stars that are kind of 4 to 9 gigayears and solar temperature are the things that sit right here. So in this distribution of rotation periods from Kepler, we simply are not seeing the old subset of stars. And if you say, let's take that Rossby number that we found from the astroseismic analysis where breaking gets funny, and say, just suppose that at that same Rossby number you cease to detect anything either, the edge would be here. So you could interpret this, I mean, the most simplistic interpretation of this distribution would be that you have some detection bias. You just don't see old, quiet things. The fact that that detection bias kicks in at exactly the same Rossby number as you found with this weird breaking behavior makes it much more suspicious. Now, if you have this strange breaking behavior, we really shouldn't be doing it with this standard model. I should institute this different breaking law. And when you do that, this is now that distribution again. What happens with this breaking law is the stars spin down until they hit a Rossby number of 2, and then they cease to spin down. And that cease, that truncation of the breaking means that they pile up at whatever period they were at when that magnetic breaking ceased. And so you end up with this overdensity of stars that are things that have shut down in terms of breaking. And you don't see that in the distribution from Kepler. So either, there are a couple of things that could easily wipe that out, though. If you introduce very modest effective temperature errors below what the estimated effective temperature errors in Kepler are, it's gone. You wipe out the overdensity. You could have, you know, if you have this phenomenon that's happening with the magnetic breaking, the large-scale strength or morphology of the magnetic field, it's not crazy to think that perhaps that change also coincides with some change in the spottedness or overall activity of stars. So it may be breaking in a combination of effective temperature errors that keeps you from seeing any of the long period stars. It may be a change in spottedness. I suspect it's probably a combination of the two. again, though.
Is there some way to measure the sort of time scale over which this is happening? Do you see, because there's, I mean, you have a lot, right, a star, so could you measure the width of that? That, you know what I mean? Like, because that's important, because then we know, like, at what time scale is the sun going to turn off its magnetic field and we're in trouble, right? I mean, basically.
I suspect you still, even with the large number of stars, I suspect you don't have a super strong constraint yet, just because those stars, you don't know where they live extremely precisely, which fuzzes things. And you're not moving very fast on that diagram by the time you're at 4 to 5 giga-years. So you're not, the difference between something that's about to turn off braking and already has is really pretty subtle.
Yeah.
And I suspect, although I need to think about it more carefully, that when you incorporate those two things together, you still don't have much leverage. I mean,
bigger data sets would give you more, I mean, this is something that could happen
larger,
with the next
astro-seismic
round.
Yeah, larger astroseismic data sets are the most important, I think.
Right.
There's also, you can test this kind of picture by saying, I'm going to go out and get rotation periods with seismology and with calcium H and K. So seismology is tracing the physical rotation period. Calcium H and K is tracing the rotation period in combination with some activity proxy. And you look to see whether they show the same trends. If you still don't see anything above this edge in those other guys, it's the breaking. If you see things above the edge in calcium and rotation, but not in spots, it's the spottedness that's the main thing that's causing the difference.
So it's not that they vanish completely because...
yeah, they're there. The stars are there.
Right, I mean, but...
You just don't detect them.
I mean, in the previous evidence of looking at the spin-down quads, seeing whether it worked for these older stars, you did have points there.
That's an uncomfortable thing to... Why is it then that we detected that sample of seismic targets? And you could worry that sample of seismic targets that's more rapidly rotating than you expected is detected because they are more rapidly rotating than expected. There's no apparent... We've done the injection and recovery exercises to show that we should have been able to detect rotation periods longer and quieter than those that were detected. There's no trend in terms of planet hosts, in terms of the difference between the non-detected and detected samples, in terms of seismology, in terms of ages, anything like that. So we do not think we are being biased by selection effect, but we definitely could. That's still a potential issue with this. That's why we need more. I mean, everybody says this, right? But we really do need more than 24 objects to really figure out if we're correct here. Okay, so I'm gonna wrap up with this little side discussion, which I think is interesting in the global, more broader context of magnetic fields. So this is another way of looking at this problem. Now, in chromospheric activity versus rotation period, the colored stars that you see here are the targets that have astroseismology, the subset of things that we've been talking about with the magnetic breaking. And the stars here represent Mount Wilson survey stars that have been tracked for many decades. The sense of evolution in this diagram is in this direction. You have rapidly rotating active young things here, slowly rotating quiet old things down here. We've been talking about a transition that happens around here with quite a bit of fuzz now to what this Rossby number actually means. And you can ask if there's other features or other places, physical things that happen on this diagram that you might be able to tie to this picture. And there's kind of two interesting observations theoretically and observationally. Observationally, there's the observation that magnetic field morphologies are changing at around a Rossby number of 1. So this is measurements with Zeeman Doppler imaging. And what you see, this is the Rossby number equals 1 line. Now remember, this Rossby number is defined similarly, but calculated slightly differently than ours. So Rossby number, don't get too attached to this being a number that's 1. I wish I understood what was going on with the projector. Okay, there we go. What you see is that stars below that have a mixture of poloidal and toroidal magnetic fields. And stars above that Rossby number are dominantly poloidal. So there's some kind of change going on there. Now, the toroidal fields are thought to be driven by the interaction with differential rotation. So it's the differential rotation of your star that takes this poloidal field and twists it into a toroidal component. when you look at theoretical simulations of differential rotation, you also see there's some kind of transition that happens at around, again, this Rossby number is calculated in yet a different way, but around a Rossby number of 1. You go from solar-like differential rotation, we have a fast equator and slow poles, to anti-solar, where you have fast poles and a slow equator. This is generic across many different people's simulations, that there's some kind of transition here. The question right now is, how do you anchor where this transition in this happens to physical quantities that we can measure for stars?
So are those calculations or those observations?
These are all calculations. There's not a single observation here.
Simulations.
This is all theoretical.
Yeah, and then the previous part, can you remind us what the symbol shape means?
This is one of those, they call this a confusogram. The color is obviously poloidal, toroidal. The star versus this, I think, is the degree of axisymmetry.
Yeah, I think
in the magnetic
right.
field. Yeah. Okay. So, again, with risking getting too attached to what the Rossby numbers actually are, here is where Rossby number of 1 sits on this diagram. Between these two guys is the so-called von Preston gap, which if I were to take all these points and pile them up against the y-axis, you'd get two peaks with a gap in between. So you can take these things and put them together and say, well, maybe what's going on here is you have a transition in your differential rotation that has this cascade of effects for your magnetic field. So you go from something, you cease to recycle your poloidal field into a toroidal component, and it culminates in this truncation of the large-scale field, or change in the strength of the large-scale field. Very hand-wavy, based on very few points. If you look at a few solar analogs, which are connected by a line here, and these things have measurements of their magnetic fields, they have ages for some of them. They have essentially almost all or all of the pieces involved in making this measurement. Some of them have differential rotation measurements. You ask, do you get the right kind of evolution? Do you go from toroidal to poloidal? Do you go from higher order field or stronger field to weaker field? Do you go from solar to anti-solar differential rotation? And the answer is, for this small subset of solar analogs, yes, with the exception of the sun, which is rotating like a solar-like differential rotation. Right. Okay, so the final plot then is just, this is the cycle period, so magnetic cycle period, measured in the Mount Wilson survey and follow-ups to it, versus rotation period. And when you look at this thing, you find that stars generally fall on one of two branches. You have the so-called active and inactive branches. Some stars show dual cycles, and they fall on, those dual cycles fall on these two branches. And then you have the sun, which falls in the middle of the two branches. And there's been a fair amount of argument back and forth as to whether there are actually objects that fill in this gap, whether the sun really does sit here alone, whether the sun's secondary cycle, which sits somewhere here, is detected or not. But with this clean subset of objects, you find that the sun is sitting in a kind of strange place. And if you take the objects that have measured rotation periods from the Mount Wilson survey and solar temperatures, which fall in this gray band, and ask what their cycle periods are, there are none. You don't detect any cycle periods in solar temperature, solar rotation period stars.
Would the sun be detectable?
The sun would, I do not know in terms of Mount Wilson survey. That I do not know. In terms of rotation, I know it's right on the edge of what we could be able to detect or not detectable. So I suspect it may be less of an interesting comparison. This upper branch to the sequence here, when you think about this in the context of what we've been talking about with Rossby number, is actually, you're looking at stars that are K stars. These have deeper convective envelopes, and even at longer rotation period, their Rossby numbers are generally equal to or less than the sun. And the ones with high Rossby numbers are actually some of the ones that fall fairly above this line, right? So these guys, if you think Rossby number is a proxy for magnetic maturity, are not as mature as the sun in this diagram. So all of these things together make you pause to wonder whether the sun is indeed in the midst of some kind of magnetic transition. You see that the breaking is changing in the seismic sample at around a solar Rossby number. You see that the spottedness, or the rotation distribution of stars, also shows some change, either in detectability or in the actual spin down that happens around this Rossby number. And in other activity proxies, the sun sits in kind of a strange place. So the question is whether or not, as we've been modeling the sun, we're actually dealing with an object that's in kind of a transition dynamo state. It's an uncomfortable statement to make. It's a little more comfortable when you realize that we're saying every star at roughly halfway through the main sequence, which is where you hit a Rossby number of 2 under traditional breaking laws, should undergo this process. And on average, if you pick a star out of the sky, it'll be roughly middle-aged. So it's less disturbing when you think that we just happen actually to be around an average star. But this is the kind of picture we put together to stimulate people into looking into this more deeply. And to try to figure out a series of tests in the future to really dig into whether or not any of these kind of bold statements that we've made are in fact reality or not. So I'll just leave up those conclusions, and if there's any more questions.
So I wonder.